From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update on news and events from the Latin America Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Okay, Tony, as usual, a lot to talk about. Let's start with Bolivia and Chile, a little more heat added to the ongoing dispute between the two over sea access for Bolivia, now expanding into some other areas.
Yeah, and we, I think in the last time we spoke about Bolivia, we were talking about the case that Bolivia has brought in the International Court of Justice in The Hague against the Chilean authority, the Chilean state, over its what Bolivia regards as its legitimate access to the sea, which it used to have territory adjacent to the Pacific Ocean, but it lost it in a war back in the 19th century.
Right.
So then, in addition to that, the last time we spoke, I think we were talking also about another case that Bolivia is bringing against Chile to do with the way Chile has exploited water resources in an area known as the Silala wetlands on the Bolivian-Chilean border. Then in what's happened over the last couple of months is, I think about 6 weeks ago, something like that, a group of nine Bolivian functionaries, customs officials and police, were arrested by the Chilean authorities at a crossing on the Chilean-Bolivian border because the Chileans claimed that the Bolivian officials were illegally acting on Chilean territory. Now, the Bolivian version is that their officials were acting to prevent contraband activities by local Chilean citizens. But what the upshot of it was that the Chilean authorities, instead of simply sending the nine officials back to Bolivia, actually put them on trial, which is an extremely hostile thing to do.
Yeah, it sort of evokes what happened to the five from Cuba with the United States. I mean, that's how hostile that is. Analogous to what happened here when you had five Cuban government officials that were investigating a terrorist plot, basically, ended up getting arrested by the U.S. and charged and imprisoned under similar circumstances.
Yeah, and in this case, the Bolivian officials who have now been released following their trial, the Bolivian government has taken on paying a very hefty fine that the Chilean judicial authorities imposed on the nine Bolivians. The Bolivian officials allege that they were suffered very serious abuse amounting to torture. At the hands of the Chilean authorities, and so that's just soured even more what was already a very sour relationship between Bolivia and Chile. And in addition, over the weekend now, President Evo Morales has kind of upped the anti-Chilean rhetoric by referring to Chile as the kind of the Cain of Latin America. The Cain and Abel story.
Right, yeah.
And so why? Because Chile is engaging in naval maneuvers with the United States that are there in the Pacific. So, and those already bad relations, complicated by these more recent developments, mean that the outlook for relations between Bolivia and Chile is not good. Meanwhile, in Chile domestically, and they have an election later this year, and they over the weekend they had primary elections to decide who was going to be the candidates for the three main blocks of political parties that will be taking part in those elections, presidential elections later this year, to replace some current president Michelle Bachelet, and that was. Very much as most people expected, that Sebastián Piñera, the former president for the Vamos Chile right-wing bloc, he won by a large margin against his nearest contender. So he'll be the right-wing candidate in the elections later this year. Beatriz Sánchez won for the Frente Amplio, which is the left-wing bloc that will be participating in the elections. And the person who's going to be representing the new majority movement, which is the political movement of which Michelle Bachelet is currently the head, a guy, I think his name is Alejandro Guille, he's going to be the candidate for the kind of centre-right, social democrat-style a political bloc of Michelle Bachelet. So, and that was quite important. But again, it looks as though that it's almost certain that Sebastián Piñera will beat whoever he faces in the runoff, because it's very unlikely that the Frente Amplio will get enough votes, although it's always possible that they might get enough votes to get into the runoff. It's more likely to be a runoff between the Nueva Mayoría candidate of Michelle Bachelet's political grouping and Piñera. So, and Piñera is likely to win because there's a lot of discontent in Chile with the situation that's developed internally under Michelle Bachelet and with the economy and so forth.
Yeah, you know, in terms of, I just want to give people a little context here. going back to the relationship between Bolivia and Chile, which is going to be affected, obviously, by the outcome of the election. There are two things people need to be aware of or keep in mind if they're aware of it. One is that Bolivia is one of two landlocked countries in South America, Paraguay being the other. And also that if you consider the fact that it does not have historic frontage on the Pacific Ocean, the implications for the relationship, for example, under a trade treaty with China are pretty large. Bolivia's political orientation is perhaps the most left and progressive one on the continent, including Venezuela, perhaps. And the relationship with China could develop along an entirely different track, much deeper, if there were access to the Pacific than having to deal with either Peru or Chile, which would be their only way of getting to the ocean. And so the geostrategic issues there with respect to China's relationship to Latin America in general hinge to a degree on this access for Bolivia, and that is going to be impacted by the outcome of this election. And you can bet that the U.S. has got its hand in here looking at that.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, you have to remember as well, Don, that Bolivia at the moment is surrounded by right-wing governments. It's Michelle Bachelet is a kind of social democrat. But if Piñera wins the elections in Chile, that'll shift Chile's stance even more to the right than it already is. Then you've got Argentina and Brazil and Peru, and they're currently all under right-wing regimes.
And Paraguay,
I beg your pardon?
And Paraguay.
Yeah, and Paraguay, of course. But and the paradoxical thing is that Bolivia has quite good relations with Peru, and it also has quite good relations with Paraguay. And in relation to the whole issue of Chinese investment in the region, and Bolivia is in some ways key, because the cross-continent railway that China is planning countries in the southern cone of and the Andean countries in South America is planned to cross Peru, Bolivia, I think Paraguay and Brazil. I think that's the route. And so Bolivia has incentives to cooperate with right-wing governments, and vice versa. Right-wing governments have incentives to cooperate with Bolivia. But as you say, and this this very unsatisfactory relationship between Bolivia and Chile is a real impediment to the development of an integrated geostrategic economic strategy for the whole region. And you can see that in the way that the Pacific Alliance countries, which is a group of countries including Chile, Colombia, Mexico, and I think Chile, Mexico, Colombia, and Peru, of course. Yeah, the four countries, Chile, Mexico, Peru, and Colombia. They were hoping, before President Donald Trump withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, to take advantage of that neoliberal model of development for the Pacific region. And once the US withdrew from the TPP, they were then faced with coming up with some kind of alternative. And one of the things that they decided to do at a meeting that they had last week was to bring in Pacific countries as observers to the Pacific Alliance process. And among those countries are a couple of countries, two or three countries from what was the TPP, including Australia and New Zealand. So that's an important development in terms of the ongoing debate in South America about, you know, how are we going to promote regional integration? Are we going to do it on a solidarity-based model that focuses on the needs of the human person, which is the model promoted by Venezuela, Cuba, Ecuador, and Bolivia, and Nicaragua, and some Caribbean island nations? Or are we going to focus on a profit-driven model focused on the corporate needs, which is the model being promoted by Chile, Colombia, Peru, and Mexico? So much of that, how that debate is going to pan out, depends so much on electoral processes that are likely to happen between now and 2019.
Yeah, and we've got a lot. Let's look at the map for a moment. We're talking about between now and 2019, Brazil, almost imminent, Argentina, Chile, which we've been talking about, Venezuela, right, and then the peace process in Colombia, however that plays. That is a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, and so in Argentina, what you've got a very important, what commentators in Argentina are regarding as a referendum in effect on Mauricio Macri's disastrous period of government since he took office back in 2016, early in 2016. Yeah. There are legislative elections in Argentina in which something like a third, I don't understand the Argentinian political parliamentary system. The elections aren't for 100% of all the Senate and all the lower house. It's for 50% of the lower house and one third of the seats in the Senate. So
that's like the U.S. model in terms of the Senate. That's what they have, 6-year terms in the U.S. Senate, and every 2 years, a third of the Senate goes. So they sort of stagger it.
So Argentina obviously has a very similar system to that in the United States. But regardless of the fact that it's not 100% of the legislature that's standing for election, it'll still be a very, very significant test for the popularity of Mauricio Macri. And it looks as though, and on current showings, that Mauricio Macri is likely to suffer quite serious electoral defeat in terms of the representation of legislators with his political views in the Argentinian legislature. And so much depends on how united the Argentinian opposition can be as they mobilize going into those elections. So it's an open question of how well they'll be able to do if they don't unite. Let's see what happens. It looks as though Cristina Kirchner has put together a political front that is likely to do very well in those legislative elections, but it's too early to say how significant that will be in terms of President Macri's ability to get legislation through the Argentinian parliamentary system.
Right.
So then in Brazil, there's a very important week ahead in Brazil again, because Michel Temer, the usurper president who ousted Dilma Rousseff last year, he is being the public prosecutor in Brazil, the national public prosecutor. I don't know if that's the equivalent of the attorney general in the United States. He has brought a case, has formally presented a case against the sitting president, President Michel Temer, in Brazil, based on allegations of corruption and organized crime. And that's just one of two or three other allegations that may turn into formal accusations. So Temer may face as many as two or three indictments for his involvement in corruption. And apparently it's being treated as organized crime as well. So that's likely to be clarified over the next week. And over the next week as well, a crucial piece of legislation that Michel Temer and his right-wing colleagues in Brazil have been pushing through is they've pushed through legislation to roll back the labor rights in Brazil. That legislation was approved in the lower house a couple of weeks ago, I think, and then it has to pass through the Senate. And it's not at all clear whether it'll pass in the Senate. That vote happens this week. Why isn't it clear? Because a Senate commission voted by something like 10 to 9. It was a very close vote against the legislation. And the opinion of that commission is likely to figure heavily in opinion in the Senate about whether or not they should approve this controversial anti-labor legislation. Right. And that's happening also in the context of massive mobilization in Brazil by the organized labor,
right,
the labor unions, who are saying that if this legislation goes through, they'll mobilize a general strike.
I mean, that's context here. You know, you have, Temer's government or whoever is really pulling the strings. He's obviously a figurehead at this point. You've got both their agenda, which is anti-labor in general. So, you know, we want to pay as little as possible and have as much control over, the workplace as we can, as opposed to labor. That's their, economic agenda. But in addition to that, you have the political agenda and looking at the presidential election that's coming, and also the organizing that's been going on a daily basis in the streets by organized labor. And so when you're looking at the attack on them, it's both in the context of their economic agenda, they're workers and we want to steal their money, but also the political sphere, we need to demobilize them or neutralize them in one way or another if we're going to retain power.
Right. So, there's all that context in Brazil, Argentina, Chile, what's happening in terms of the developments with the countries of the Pacific Alliance. And of course, all that's very relevant for the situation in Colombia, which is a member of the Pacific Alliance, and also, of course, for the critical situation in Venezuela.
Yep.
Where a poll came out in Venezuela over the weekend by the Hinterlaces opinion poll company, which is regarded as a pretty reliable company as opposed to the data analysis polling company, which is heavily biased in favor of the Venezuelan right wing. The Hinterlaces company came out with a poll that says that 58% of Venezuelans support Nicolas Maduro as the person they want to lead Venezuela out of its current crisis, and only 32% support the opposition.
Wow.
Now that's a very, very important result.
Yeah.
Because it confirms what we've been discussing on this in our conversations over the last several months now, the fact that the Venezuelan opposition do not have a democratic majority in Venezuela.
Right. Wow. You know what surprises me? You've got 10% with everything that's going on there. You've got 10% that aren't figured in that. In other words, don't knows or don't cares or polling error. If you got 58 to 32 is what you said, right?
Right.
Yeah. So that's at least 10% out under the right. You know, pressure cooker conditions that exist right now. That's amazing, all by itself.
And that gives you some idea of how misleading the Western media coverage is of the situation in Venezuela, which is critical.
Yeah.
But it's critical because the opposition refused to accept that they don't have a majority.
Right.
Well, they have a golden opportunity with the constituent assembly that's being organized for the 30th of July. The elections for the constituent assembly will be held on the 30th of July, and something like a total of well over 500 representatives of the whole of Venezuelan society will be elected to look at ways of improving Venezuela's constitution to enable it to avoid the kind of crisis that it's currently in.
Yeah.
Now, if the Venezuelan opposition had a majority in the country, they'd just take part in those elections because the electoral authority is very reliable in Venezuela. And although the Venezuelan opposition say that they don't trust the vote, that's what they're saying. They don't trust the vote of being organized for July the 30th. It was that same voting system which enabled them to win control
of the National Assembly. It's a ridiculous claim. The very pulpit from which they make the proclamation about this, they were, you know, administered right to that spot by that exact apparatus. They said, you won, here you go, swear you win, all that stuff.
Yes, and very clearly, the reason they're not participating in the Constituent Assembly vote is because they know they don't have a majority.
Right. So let me ask you a question before. You know, you had this attack, and I haven't really reported yet on, you know, on this incident either, which took place last week, I think, with the helicopter attack on the Supreme Court. How do you think that plays politically? I mean, I'm someone living in a country that has some at least economic insecurity because of what's been, you know, done to it, but from the outside and from within. I'm trying to figure out, gee, should we have a change in direction? Who would be better to lead this? And then you see maniacs crashing helicopters into the Supreme Court. That's got to have a negative impact on the popularity of the opposition.
Yeah, and we've said this before. And the violence that is being promoted from the country's National Assembly by leading political figures...
Yeah.
And from important governorships in, for example, Henry Capriles in Miranda.
Yeah.
Henry Capriles is a fascist politician that took part in the 2002 coup.
Yep.
And they, you know, in this supposed dictatorship, these politicians are able to encourage violent attacks against not just the government or institutions that represent the government, but against army bases and against ordinary businesses. What their strategy has been is not to try and foment violence in major urban centers, but to focus on smaller urban centers where they bus in 400 or 500 of their supporters from around Venezuela, terrorize commercial districts in smaller towns.
Right, they can overwhelm those because of the scale.
Yeah. So, and Venezuela is a huge country. It's impossible for the authorities to be monitoring every small town in the whole of Venezuela.
Right.
And the Venezuelan opposition take advantage of that to project an image as if there's nationwide mayhem, when in fact they target very specifically small towns where they're able to terrorize the population and that's their strategy. And then that gets projected into at an international level,
right,
as if the whole of the country is subject to this kind of disruption and mayhem.
And domestically too. Let's, you know, you have a small district over here that, you know, that this happens to. The private media, which is the bulk of the media there, blows this up as if, you know, see this thing. And what it does is it tells people in Caracas, you know, in larger places, you know, this is happening inside this country. It could happen to you too. In other words, it's a campaign of terror, really. It's a terror. It's a terrorism strategy, insurrectional terrorism, and what it does, its purpose is to incite fear. And because, I mean, it's like using this small town as a set for a, you know, a dramatic presentation that's now used to scare the hell out of people.
Yeah, and I think the most recent attack was an attack on a town called Marais, and I'm not sure in which state it was, but in that attack, the authorities actually managed to arrest about 200 people, and those people were all very clear that they'd been bussed in from other parts of Venezuela, and they'd been paid to attack commercial districts and create this impression of collapse in law and order for the very purpose that you just said, to instill terror in people locally and to project that, if possible, nationally.
Right.
And that's what that helicopter attack was about. Right. And the idea was to suggest that because the helicopter was hijacked from a police institution, and so the object of that attack was to give the impression that even the police authorities and perhaps the army too were turning against the government, which is not the case.
Right.
And of course, it has to be remembered that this is all very carefully orchestrated. None of this is by accident. Because that all these events are happening in the context of a very carefully planned international strategy attacking the Venezuelan government, of which Luis Almagro, the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, is a leading player. And these events took place in the context of a meeting in the Organization of American States to discuss the situation in Venezuela, quite illegally, of course. And but even despite that, Venezuela is both at an international level, thanks to the prestige that the Venezuelan government enjoys, especially among Caribbean island nation states, but also at a national level, because the Venezuelan opposition have no strategy except destruction and intimidation and terrorism. That's their strategy. So the whole strategy is failing, but that just makes them more and more desperate.
Right.
So they're going to accentuate the terrorist violence in Venezuela if they can, because they need to do two things. They need to try and provoke the government into allowing the security forces to use lethal force,
right,
so that they can then claim that the government is
murdering attacking protesters.
Yeah, right. That's the phrase, isn't it, that they use so often in Libya, Syria, anywhere that the United States government wants to overthrow a recalcitrant government.
Yep.
And the other thing that they're trying to do is to create an environment in which people will be afraid to go and vote on July the 30th.
Right. Same again. So here we go. It's intended also for domestic, particularly in that case, for domestic consumption to terrorize people. You know, we're going to have to pick it up here next week, but because I think maybe we should lay out a map of elections with dates over the next year and a half or so. You know, going out to say Lula, which is going to be a really important one because of, you know, Brazil's size and its membership in BRICS and some other things.
Yeah, and of course we should also talk about Colombia if we get the chance, because the processes, the peace process there has made significant advances, along with also significant problems. And of course, Colombia has elections next year as well.
And we just had a little health scare with the head of the FARC too, which we'll talk about. He's apparently going to be okay. It was apparently a TIA instead of a stroke. But yeah. All right, Tony, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thanks, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.